All right. I'm just going to keep it going.
Okay.
So we are at, it's been a while. Let's see what number we're at here. Man, oh man. Last episode we did was What the Facts Part 2, More Facts. So it's episode 1065.
I'm glad we're taking so long to 1075.
Yeah, I was reviewing my list today, and I'm down to 1.5. I think that's true.
I'm at 2.5.
And I think I might want to propose to you that we end those 75 rewatches.
I'm okay with that.
I like how we're just, this year, shoving things aside and just...
If we don't want to do them, we don't
do them. Yeah, I don't want to do them anymore.
Yeah.
I don't want to do a bunch of things.
I agree.
If, you know, now that you're having another child, my family stuff is picking up. Just busy, busy, busy. We might have to just be okay with. Sometimes we go 3 weeks. Sometimes we go 2 weeks. Not my favorite thing.
Right.
Especially when you have three awesome episodes lined up.
I agree. We'll just have to see how it goes. Maybe what we can do, because the only part I don't like is like when we're doing a read through.
Yeah,
like,
that's true. I know
that kind of sucks. So maybe we could find, you know, an hour like, remotely sometime in the week today.
Yeah. So now we're over on the main feed. We're just continuing a conversation that Ben and I had over on the uncensored feed, but we had to just take 3 weeks off, and now next week we also have to find a new date to record, and then the week after that, I have to find it. So, like, you've got some work obligations. I've got some family stuff. Crazy.
Right.
All right. Let's get to it. This is episode 1065.
Episode 1065, Seeing with Ian, Rise of the Machines. I can't remember if we were numbering the Seeing with Ian or not.
No, we're not.
Okay.
So that's perfect. Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Ed Edison.
I'm Ben DiBono. We're back with an episode that I hope I'm able to convey what is on my mind for this one. Because this is, to me, a couple of things by way of introduction. So this is going to be the first of really a three-part episode in a way. Distinctive topics, but I think there's a through line through all of them. So the first one's going to be this one tonight, where we're going to talk about this problem that Ian McGilchrist and The Matter with Things, which is what we've been exploring in the Seeing with Ian series, identifies for us. I think next time I want to talk about this long-awaited doppelganger episode, which has had a few iterations, and I think it's finally landed here. And there's parts of it I want to explore that maybe don't line up perfectly with this, but there's a lot with doppelgangers that we're going to talk about, and I'll maybe preview that a bit more at the end. And then the third one is what I'm calling the Butlerian Manifesto. So if you've read Dune, that probably makes some sense to you. If you haven't, well, you don't need to, but you also have to be in the dark for a few more weeks until we get there. But I think this episode especially, as we've been going through this book, The Matter with Things, you don't have to have read along. You know, I think I'm the only one who's read it, probably of most of the people listening, and we're not doing a read-through like we are with some of the Dune stuff. But I'll say the content that we're going to cover tonight with it, I think I found and have found in the last month or so since I read it, genuinely life-changing. I think that there's potential in this material to radically start to shake up the way that you live in certain ways. And it may, if I can risk overstating it, the stakes of this may be how human you are willing to be. For my part here, as we talk about some of the argument we're going to put forward, is around what does it look like when society as a whole starts to sacrifice their humanity in a meaningful way, almost starts to take on a mental illness, but deliberately so. What does it look like to begin to step out of that? I found it enormously convicting and challenging when I read it, and I have been attempting, imperfectly, but attempting to reorder my life around some of the principles discussed in this week's material. So I think it's big stuff. And I want to set that up not because it's like, oh, I'm about to just deliver the greatest episode to you you've ever heard. I actually am setting that up because I'm worried I'm not, because I think this material is so deep and so profound that I'm worried that my delivery is inadequate, and I want to at least throw out the high-level idea so people have something to look for and glom onto as we go through this, so that where I'm inadequate, at least there's kind of that thread to look for. The basic thread in a nutshell, the thesis here of this last chapter of part one in the matter of things, is that humanity, as we go through this whole right brain, left brain idea and this shift of societal values, and you can listen to the other Sea and Athena episodes for more info on that. The very, very short version, just to reset it for everybody who maybe needs a quick refresher, your left hemisphere is really interested in details. It's interested in categorizing things. It's interested in getting things neatly ordered. Your right brain is interested in the big picture, and your right brain is actually connected to reality. You know, details are important, but they're important because of how they map onto reality. They're not reality in and of itself. And some of the things we've seen in this series is that as we go down this left hemisphere path and we start focusing more on details and categorization and all of that, we actually begin to live in a artificial world. You know, it's like I've used the analogy of an atlas. It's not the world, it's a map, it's an abstraction of that. And so what does it mean when society starts to go down there? So the thesis statement of this material is, by society making the left hemisphere the primary way of looking at the world instead of the supporting role that it ought to have, has taken on the characteristics of serious mental illness, and we are sacrificing our humanity as a result. And some of the main culprits are our use of technology and our use of some of our societal convictions. To put it another way, for those who have read Dune, this will be familiar. For those who haven't, it's not a spoiler. But in Dune, there's a concept in the world of the Butlerian Jihad. Butlerian Jihad is an event in that world where humans kind of rise up against the machines, against robots and all of that. And you think, well, it's like Terminator. It's actually not. It is if you read the Brian Herbert pretend prequels. But the idea in Frank Herbert is not that it's that. The idea with Frank Herbert that he puts out is that humanity gave their thinking over to machines and it enslaved them. And so, although Ian McGilchrist doesn't reference Dune anywhere in there in this material, this is my own connection, that's the thesis statement. We are actually in the process of that happening right now, and the effects are already there. All right? So, let's get into it. There's any questions from you. You get to be the audience proxy here.
Yeah, I think that's a good setup. Although I've talked with you a lot about this over the last few months, so I kind of know where you're coming from, and I understand what Frank Herbert was thinking. And so it sounds like you're saying, maybe accidentally, Ian here has the same viewpoint on technology as Frank Herbert did.
I think so. You know, I think so. And I think that I don't want to put words into Ian's mouth, but I think it's interesting that, you know, as we read through Dune over on the extra feed, it's not just a science fiction work, it's a deeply philosophical work. And it's especially as we've gotten into some of the middle books in the series, it's a work on what it means to be human.
It has been interesting for me as a co-host, but also a listener to you, as you're going through your presentations for Dune and for the main feed. There's overlap, but accidentally for us. We didn't plan for the Dune material to overlap with what you're learning from McGilchrist, right?
Right.
Yeah, so it's been, I mean, we're kind of flowing from episode and main feed to Patreon feed, but the conversation is sort of continuing all over the place. It's kind of a continuous thread, it feels like.
It is, and I think what's interesting is obviously Frank Herbert died before Ian McGilchrist was writing. I have no evidence that Ian McGilchrist has ever read anything by Frank Herbert, and I'm sure that if we were to get into the nitty-gritty of their specifics, we'd find plenty of points of disagreement or where they don't align. But in the large, the big picture, the high level strokes of things, they've reached the same conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of them reaches it through a novel, and so there's going to be artistic outworking of that. But honestly, that's one of the things we're going to look at here some tonight, and especially next week, is what is the artistic outworking of this. All right, so let's get into it. So the basic, this last chapter in part one starts to get into how some of the features of mental illness, specifically schizophrenia, and what that looks like in relation to brain dysfunction, and, you know, what happens when the right hemisphere isn't functioning properly, and how does that line up with the symptoms of schizophrenia? And then later on, as we'll see as we go, society and how society is operating as well. So he starts out with, I think, what is a really, really important distinction, which is that mental illness, brain issues, any of this stuff is not just a, you know, it's not an illness in the sense, or at least not just an illness in the sense of, oh, I have a cold or I have a fever, or even a more serious illness. It actually leads to a change in reality. It says, mental illnesses and brain diseases are sometimes discussed as though they were like mechanical faults, but they are not. It's not that the mind doesn't work properly, as if a component has ceased to function. In the first place, when something is altered in the brain or the mind, it is never just a component, inert and isolated. Brains and minds are living, constantly adapting, interconnected systems, and they are conscious. A brain disease or mental illness, then, is a change in a person's whole way of being in the world. Okay, so when I, you know, you get a bad cold or whatever, I go through allergy season every August, and, you know, it does impact you from the way you approach things, because you feel crappy, you feel sluggish and everything. And I guess you could argue that that impacts how you feel, you know, see reality. But it's kind of a low level. It's similar to how, well, reality is going to look different to me when I'm hungry or when I haven't slept well, as opposed to when I'm well fed or rested, you know. So we have low level stuff like this. But obviously, when we're talking about mental illness or issues with the brain and some of the material we've seen thus far in the book, it's an order of magnitude differently. So it's not just you're sick. It's that reality has started to function in a different way for you. And I think that's a really key point as we go on. And so as we start to talk about schizophrenia, what are some of the features of that? Well, the first one that he brings up, and these aren't necessarily in his order, but I'm just going to go through these, and we're going to kind of see along the way how some of these start to map onto where we as a society are at. So the first one is that schizophrenics tend to be more interested in mapping instead of living. So he says, one way of looking at schizophrenia would be this. The subject is struggling with a left hemisphere whose linguistic and conceptual functioning is impaired by the encroachment on it of what should be going on separately in the right hemisphere, meaning that you have functions that should be happening in the right hemisphere because the right hemisphere isn't working. They're now happening in the left hemisphere instead, and they're getting jumbled. Okay. And meanwhile, the reality-oriented functioning of the right hemisphere is impaired by the intrusion into it of what should be going on separately in the left. You might think of it as like trying to map what you are living instead of living it, and at the same time, trying to live in the map. So he brings up the, you know, he has two lists here, and they're contrasting between, you know, this is the experience of somebody with a healthy brain versus this is the experience of somebody with schizophrenia. So life versus map, instinct versus brain, feeling versus thought, trust and impressions versus demand for proof, movement versus immobility, events and persons versus objects, presence versus representation, flow versus measure. So you can start to see there's a shift. There's a shift from this sort of organic way of living to a very rigid mechanical way of living. And the point isn't that the things on that second list are bad. Obviously, we need to be able to have maps, and we need to have thoughts, and we need to measure, and we need to have all of that. But really, his contention through his whole work, and I haven't read it, but his first book is called The Master and His Emissary. The argument is the right hemisphere that lives in reality primarily should be the master. The left hemisphere should be the emissary. Is what the left hemisphere does bad? No, but it needs to be subordinate to what's happening in the right. Obviously, this is high level. We could find examples where that doesn't apply. And so what we see in a schizophrenic patient then is the combination of the two, and indeed the subordination of the master to the emissary. That's the argument. So going on then, we also get with mental illness then a loss of hierarchy. Everything seems to grip my attention. This is a patient speaking, although I'm not particularly interested in anything. I'm speaking to you just now, but I can hear noises going on next door and in the corridor. I find it difficult to shut them out, and it makes it more difficult for me to concentrate on what I'm saying to you. Often the silliest little things that are going on seem to interest me. That's not even true. They don't interest me, but I find myself attending to them and wasting a lot of time this way. I know that sounds like laziness, but it's not really. Okay, so what's going on there? Well, he starts talking about this as a loss of hierarchy. Now, you think of hierarchy as like an org chart. Well, not quite. Hierarchy is your sensory input, your senses are getting a gajillion pieces of data all the time. You, as a person, are able to prioritize what matters and what doesn't. Like right now, you know, I'm getting sensory input on the color of your wall behind me, but that's not, I mean, outside of this moment where I'm talking about it, like that's not, that just kind of washes over. There's a hierarchy. My notes are more important. They're higher in the hierarchy than the color of the wall is. So in mental illness, then that collapses. You know, it starts to shift, not because that's more interesting necessarily or more important, or maybe I don't even recognize it, but because there's this flattening. Reality doesn't allow us to, reality's not functioning properly for you.
I actually don't love the color of the wall behind me.
It is kind of a puke yellow.
It was the color that was there when we bought this house. And if you had asked me without me looking, what color is it? I would have said kind of greenish. But then when I just looked back, I was amazed to find it's definitely a dark yellow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but that's kind of it, right? Like there's clearly that idea is there, and it's taken on enough of a importance in your attention hierarchy where you knew it wasn't red. Now, green, yellow, they're kind of in the same ballpark, but not enough where you could have rattled it off.
Wow.
Whereas, you know, what color is your car? You could probably tell me that. It's higher in your attention hierarchy. And so this is where we start to get some distinct or some comparisons to modernity. So Ian says, this again, meaning the same phenomenon, seems to describe an aspect of modern information-soused, overstimulated condition. As in modern life, there is no hierarchy of importance, but a democracy of the importune. I was like, well, what's he getting at there? Okay, think about it this way. When you are, if you're living 30 years ago, maybe even rewind it farther than that, the amount of things competing for your attention form more naturally into a hierarchy you can deal with, right? You know, rewind the clock a couple hundred years ago. So let's go pre-modern on it, or at least pre-technological revolution. Yeah, you know, you're not always going to function perfectly with that, but there's a sense of what's important and what's not. Well, you start to add in media, you know, get into the 20th century. Now this starts to get jumbled. A, there's a lot more of it. There's a lot more of it. And suddenly what's important, what's not, gets confusing. Now you flash forward to where we are now, and it's not just that there's infinitely more of it than you could ever comprehend. It's that our hierarchy is screwed up with it. Why? Part of it is because we tend to go to what's easier rather than what's better, and partly because it's algorithmically driven. So when you get onto Twitter, Facebook, Google, pretty much anything, those are the explicit examples, but all of the interconnected Internet of Things world that we live in is absorbing this data from you. The algorithm is designed to usurp your hierarchy of importance. That's actually happening. Okay. So this is not in a vacuum. We'd say, oh, small potatoes. We're going to go on and we're going to see more examples of this. But this is one way where you start to see schizophrenia, mental illness, brain damage. This hierarchy gets messed up. It's being done to you, and you're doing it to yourself. So if that's true, we're going to see more, but I want to make the point strongly here so that we can see it more later on. If that's true, you're actually contributing with your own erosion of reality simply by living in the world as it is right now. Okay. So let's go on then. Second area. Schizophrenia tends to deal with levels of abstraction. Indeed, excessive abstraction has been described as probably at the source of a cognitive deficit in schizophrenia, living in the map, not the world. Words that refer only to other words, abstractions that become more real than actualities, symbols that usurp the power of what they symbolize, the triumph of theory over embodied experience. I believe there are resonances here with academic trends in the humanities, with scientism, and even with the world picture of the average Western citizen. Jumping ahead. Concrete instances are always unique. Only an abstraction can be general. The abstractions for which the left hemisphere has an affinity are derived from the unique incarnate cases taken in by the right hemisphere and are therefore secondary to them. Yet from the left hemisphere's own viewpoint, not having insight into what the right hemisphere knows, the situation appears reversed, and abstractions come to appear in Platonic fashion more real than the real world, instances from which they are derived. Thus the dramatist Anton Artaud, who suffered from schizophrenia, remarked, "I go from the abstract to the concrete and not from the concrete toward the abstract." Okay, so what's he getting at there? Let's actually start at the second one and work our way backwards. So we have then this concept of the abstract, the general, the principle has to derive from the concrete, not the other way around. The other way around is a Platonic way of looking at it. The abstract, the form, is what's real. The concrete is the shadow. Okay? Aristotelian metaphysics, which, oh, by the way, Christian theology is rooted in Aristotelian metaphysics, or at least I'd argue that it is. Certainly in the West it is. Certainly in the Thomist tradition it is. Flips that. We get the abstract from looking at what's real, okay? And you can see the interplay of right hemisphere and left hemisphere. Which one, based on what we've learned about left hemisphere and right hemisphere, would somebody living with a subordinate right hemisphere and the left hemisphere in the master position, which one would they be drawn to? 100% the one you can categorize, the one you can nail down. Okay, so then you think about, well, what does he mean when he says that's like the average experience of the Western citizen today? Well, think about it in a lot of ways. We live in a world of abstraction, you know, and you can see this in very concrete ways. You can see it in abstract ways. Like a more abstract one that's maybe feels less close to home, politics is an abstraction. Politics exists 100% in abstraction. Why? It's too big. It can't wrap its hands around the concrete. So you abstract your opponents, you abstract yourself. You know, if you're running for office, especially at the federal level, your goal is to get people to buy into your abstraction, both for yourself and of what the opponent is. You're not dealing with concrete. It doesn't exist. You know, our entire financial system is buried in layers upon layers upon layers of abstraction. Like, what does it mean? You know, what is a dollar tied to? I'm not like on the hobby horse for the gold standard. I don't understand it enough to have that opinion. But the one thing I do understand enough is that, you know, if you have something like the gold standard, there is something real there. And again, I'm not recommending it because I don't understand the economics of it enough to have an opinion. But I understand this principle enough to say, even if this was the right choice to move away from that, we've lost something. We're buried in abstraction upon abstraction.
Can I admit something?
Yeah.
I just found out last week about what you're describing as
the gold standard.
I never really knew. Oh. So in case there's any listeners out there who are in the same boat as me, I didn't realize that in the past, every dollar, every piece of paper that you had that we call $1 bills.
Right.
There it was an equivalent of that value in gold.
Yes.
At Fort Knox, right? Is that where it was?
I don't know the specifics.
I guess I don't know where it was. So I'll back up one step. I don't know where it was, but somewhere in the United States, there was enough gold that equaled your $1 bill.
Yeah, you could theoretically exchange your dollar for an actual piece of gold.
So
probably not a large one.
Yeah. At some point, the government changed their method of creating dollar bills. And
Federal Reserve, and you can find a lot of very strong opinions about this. So I'm not trying to go there, but I am trying to point out there's an abstraction we've bought into. Maybe it was good. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. I don't know enough about it to say for sure. But what I do know isn't good is we have so many layers of abstraction now. Okay, so everything's virtual. Like, what drives the value of your money right now? Is it anything real? Not really. What drives the stock market? What's the number one most important factor in the stock market?
I think public perception.
Belief. Right? Why? Because there's so much complexity there that it's abstraction. Like when bad news is announced, the stock market goes down. Not because anybody's actually panicked, but because they are panicking about other people panicking. Mm-hmm. Like even in our abstraction, you've got about 15 layers there. Okay, so that one's like, those are some high level ones, but I'll give you one that really hit home to me when I was on vacation a month ago. And it's through reading this material, I decided to make a very conscious choice, and I've tried to maintain it since, to be on my phone much, much, much less. So I'm sitting out on the beach at night, I'm reading, and or during the day, multiple times throughout the week, and I see people walk up to the ocean, and they're holding their phone, and they're recording it through that. I'm not talking about taking a picture. I'm talking about extended time and multiple people looking at the ocean through their phone. What is your phone? Your phone's an abstraction layer. Okay, so then like start to pull on that thread, and holy crap, does it get uncomfortable really, really, really quick. Social media is an abstraction of your life and a dishonest one. Sometimes more, sometimes less, but always a dishonest one. You know, so we're interacting with people more through layers of abstraction. It's one reason I'm highly skeptical about virtual only work, right? Not that there isn't a place for it. Not that I don't ever take advantage of it. I do. Like, this is where, you know, we have to be very careful not to be dogmatic, because the takeaway isn't all these things are bad all the time forever. But the point is, we have introduced so many layers of abstraction into our lives, and COVID with the push to remote work delivered a huge one, and it has good things about it. That's not the point. But the point is, if living in abstraction is eroding our sense of reality, it's actually making us less human. That's something we should take seriously, right? Doesn't mean that, you know, you have to throw away your phone. But when I saw that, it's like these people who are sitting there looking at the ocean through their phone are less human. You might say that's a strong way to put it. I actually think that's true. They are less human. Well, what does it mean to be human? Well, I want to define being human as living properly in the world. So to put it in Ian McGilchrist terms, it would be having the master be the master and the emissary be the emissary.
I can't remember which episode you and I talked about this, but I tend to take a lot of pictures and take a lot of video, especially with the kids. And my wife had asked me to not, especially when it comes to video, not take so much video, but more be in the moment.
Yeah.
And then you and I had this conversation recently about, you know, similar topic. And so I have been trying over the last 3 weeks or so, whenever you and I talked about this, to take less pictures and take less video and just live through it. And I think you're the one that told me that if you don't take pictures, you'll actually remember those moments more.
Yeah, I think we'll get to that quote here. Yeah. I think I have it in my notes, but it's a good point to bring up now. You know, it's true. It's true. It's like, you know, one of the traps I've fallen into that I think a lot of people fall into is multi-screening. So you're watching something.
Oh, yeah.
You're on your phone. I've intentionally stopped doing that.
Okay.
And let's say, you know, not that I'm 100% perfect, but I'd say I've probably reduced the amount I do that by 90% or more. It's hard, but it's better. You feel more engaged with what you're doing. You feel more human. You actually do. You know, it's a powerful thing. And it's like the principle with all of this isn't, you know, go off and be perfect or you're not a human. Like, what if, as we're going through this, and there's a lot more to cover here, but what if you tried to be 10%? What if you tried to do 10% better the next month? Well, that doesn't mean that you're smashing your phone. Doesn't mean that you're not doing any of this. No. But what if you were just tried to be 10% better? That could be revolutionary. You know? And maybe there's a point where you're like, I'm good. Okay, that's fair enough. Like, one of the principles I'm trying to import from Frank Herbert here with Dune is that ideology is itself its own form of mental illness. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means that, like, we could come out of this as total ideologues. That's not the point, because we can look at all of this stuff and we can find good things about it. Okay? So great. Like, the principle isn't don't take pictures, but the principle is maybe we have crossed a line we shouldn't cross, and that if we don't uncross it soon, we as individuals, as a species, are going to have a very hard time uncrossing it. Let's go on, because now we start to get into body horror a little bit. And this is really interesting to me, because this is where, like, light bulbs just started flashing as I was reading it. Says, one patient says, I feel distant from myself. It's as if the body were there by itself, without being coordinated with anything else. I have the feeling of unharmony, of a separation from inside, which is where I feel the vital force flowing. Sometimes it's as if I weren't the one who was thinking. The body is something that functions, not something that's mine that I live. I live my life in the third person. And he goes on, We'll come to the loss of vitality in the third-person perspective in due course. Another patient reports the body is emptied out like a husk. There is no inside of the body, but only a frame. He says that when he eats, the food is falling in a vacuum. Behind the chest is nothing, only a big hole. One of Bluer's patients, I don't know who that is, but psychologist he's referencing, exclaimed, body and soul don't belong together. There is no unity. What seems to be happening here is diminishment, evisceration, an alienation of the body in relation to the mind, the birth of Cartesian dualism, of which we are all the heirs. Okay, so this gets wild. So if he's right, then we would expect features of this to start creeping into modern society with the rise of the machines, as I'm putting it. Okay? Say, well, I don't think so. You know, I don't feel separated from my body. Well, let's take a look at art in the 20th century. One of the books we've read for the book poster, Kafka's Metamorphosis. Mm-hmm. Why do you all of a sudden have books like Metamorphosis, which, if you're not familiar with it, Gregor Samsa wakes as a giant beetle, and that's the book. You have that. And I started to think about, okay, that's one example, and Kafka kind of reflects this, but what else is going on? What if we were to keep pulling on that thread? Is there more? Yeah, there's a ton more. A Philip K. Dick, you know, somebody who exhibited symptoms of schizophrenia. Why does his art resonate so much? Because it feels true on one level. Like, if you haven't read Philip K. Dick, you're not familiar with him. So much of his stuff is about the nature of reality. You know, he wrote Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which was the novel that was the source for Blade Runner. Well, if you've seen Blade Runner, of course, the debate is Deckard a replicant? Robot, if you haven't seen the movie. Well, that's very intentional in the work. Like, you start out with your human character, and maybe he's not human. Maybe he's really a machine. David Cronenberg. I don't think you've watched any David Cronenberg. No, I think you'd hate him. But, like, body horror is his thing. You know, The Fly is, of course, a classic example. Things like Videodrome, which is all about media having this physical, disgusting effect. I just watched his movie Crash, which is a really messed up movie, and I didn't think it would have, you know, I didn't think it would have any of it. So Crash is, and I'll describe it in PG terms, it's about people who, let's say, have an erotic reaction to car crashes, to car accidents. And so it's like, well, this is kind of a weird movie, and it is, and I don't know if I quite recommend it. I don't quite not recommend it. Don't recommend it for you. You'd hate it.
Thank you.
But there's a line in there where one of the characters says, like, halfway through the movie, technology is changing the human body. Like, holy crap, that's it. So here, you know, it's less fantasy than Videodrome is or The Fly, but it's the same principle. Technology is changing the human body. I forget exactly how they put it in the movie, but that's the substance of it. Like, holy crap, why does that resonate? I think of somebody like H.R. Giger, who did a lot of the conceptual art for Alien. You go look at his prints. It's very much this fusion of machine and human. This is all over the place. This is all over the place. Why does it resonate? Maybe part of why it resonates is that we're walking around with machines. We live 90% of our lives through them. Like, it's actually shockingly prophetic when you think about it. The human body is changing because of technology. Movies made in the 90s based on a book from the 70s, and it's shockingly prophetic. Just that line. You know, it doesn't mean we're all having sex and car crashes. That's not the point. Like, that's like the artistic outworking of it. But why does something that messed up resonate to the extent that it does on an artistic level? It's because we're living it. Like, your life right now is low-key body horror. And what is body horror? Body horror is the transformation of your physical body due to technology. That's how I would describe it in a nutshell. So Franz Kafka, forerunner to David Cronenberg, you know, but it's like, yeah, man, it's all over the place artistically, all over the place. Somebody I'm not going to touch on today, but I'll give you a sneak preview for next week when we start talking about doppelgangers. David Lynch captures this tension better than anybody I'm aware of from an artistic perspective. So if you've seen Twin Peaks, evil is associated with the mechanical, you know, and you see this in a lot of his movies, not just Twin Peaks, but like Eraserhead, you know, the machine, the factory, the monstrous is coming from this very mechanical place. And it's like, this is at a very visceral level for David Lynch. You know, it's as something as simple as you will hear mechanical sounds associated with evil in his movies. You know, so it's like at this very subconscious level. What's associated with good? Things like eating pie and drinking coffee and like this very human, non-technological thing. Like, and I don't think David Lynch would ever put it in these terms as consciously, but what's going on there? He's artistically working out this same tension. He's doing it in terms of good versus evil. And if he's right, you don't have to agree with him, but just entertain it for a second. If he's right, you have to ask, which side are we on right now as a society? Which side are you on? When you walk up to the ocean with your phone and are looking at it through a screen, what side are you on? Maybe you don't agree that it's good versus evil. Maybe that's too strong. Maybe it is. But what side are you on? You know, it's something to think about. All right, so then we go on. Ultra-rationalism. This is something that comes out a lot in today's world. For such patients as for certain scientists and philosophers, the human being is itself reduced to a mechanism. Thus, according to one schizophrenic subject, man is merely a heap of memories and a standard hardware. To another, everyone is talking to each other and I can't figure out the mechanism. One day, the day will come and we'll see that it's all quite mechanical. Well, there is a there are cognitivist scientists to whom this would seem to make perfect sense, and for whom it would even be a welcome advance. I doubt this means that schizophrenics are seers and philosophers with privileged insight into the nature of being, any more than they are spiritual masters, but that more probably there's something very odd that happens to the world once you view it in the way towards with our unbalanced analytical tradition in philosophy and our unbalanced technological tradition in science leads us. A tradition in which most academics now are so thoroughly schooled that they can't see that there is a problem, let alone how to escape it. Yeah. And so let me go dip my toe into some waters that could make some listeners angry. But I'm going to do it because I have no fear. I actually think this is part of why Neo-Calvinism is taking off and has had a renaissance theologically. Because Neo-Calvinism is the Christian theological equivalent of this. Doesn't mean it's not true.
You're going to define it?
Yeah, it's Neo-Calvinism. In its most extreme form would be like the John Piper best of all possible worlds, that there is no such thing as free will. You know, The only difference is between that and the atheistic philosophers who want to reduce everything to mathematics is that God is the machine. Like, Neo-Calvinism, in its most extreme forms, and I'm saying that deliberately because I understand there's nuances and room for gray, and I don't want to sweep too much with too broad of a brush, but it fundamentally reduces God to a machine.
And then we are a simulation.
Essentially.
Because we have no control over any of our actions.
Yeah, what's the difference between what John Piper believes in simulation theory? Like, I'll go one further. What's the difference between what John Piper believes and what Sam Harris believes? Sam Harris, of course, one of the renowned neo-atheists. Well, you say there's a lot. They disagree on everything. Yeah, and they come to the same conclusion. What's the same conclusion? Where there's no free will. You're just a machine. That's what it comes down to.
Atheists think that we're just machines?
Not all atheists, but atheists who want to reduce things. If everything's reduced to mathematics, then yes, you're essentially just a machine. There's no free will.
Just
everything's
with animal
an illusion.
Responses.
Exactly. Not even that. All of that's an illusion.
Okay.
You know, and that's what John Piper believes. The only difference is it's not mathematics, it's God. And I think they're both fairly monstrous ways to view the world. They certainly aren't human ways to view the world. You know, it's like there's this logical, this deeply logical drive behind strains. Again, I'm not painting everybody with this broad brush of neo-Calvinism. And I think it's really destructive. And I think it's anti-human. Okay. Doesn't mean that they're bad people. Doesn't mean they don't do good things. Doesn't mean God hasn't used them, because all of that's true, right? But it does mean that there's something about that that's off. And like, you contrast that to how Tolkien viewed the world, and I think this would actually be a really interesting episode. You know, Tolkien's view of us as sub-creators. God created us to be sub-creators. That's radically different. Radically, radically different. Like, when John Piper says, and I'm sorry to pick on John Piper, but I'm picking on John Piper. You know, he has a way bigger audience than me. So this is kind of David and Goliath, and I'm the little guy, if you think about it. So, like, when he says that the goal is for God to be most glorified in this world, it sounds really good. It's also very mechanical. There is no room for human. That's not a world where God invites his creatures, his people, to be sub-creators. It's not. If you want to believe God is made, and does God want us to glorify him? Absolutely. But it's not this mechanical world where the John Pipers of the world would go so far as to say the torture of sinners in hell is part of the machine.
So I don't know if you and me are totally on the same page, but I guess in some ways I would agree, in some ways I wouldn't agree. One thing that you're saying, are you emphasizing too much the importance of humans? For example, like, none of this is really about us. It's about God. So, yeah. So
sub-creators. Sub-creators. So it is, I'm emphasizing the importance of humans because God emphasizes the importance of humans. That'd be my theological argument. So, and that's the trick that the neo-Calvinists play is, well, it is all about God. Yes. So what does God say? He says, I've made you in my image and I've given you dominion. Okay. So for it to be all about God, we have to go down to that level of sub-creators and free will. And what does that mean? Like, either this world, from a theological perspective, is a mechanical universe and we're just here for God's own benefit, which is essentially what John Piper believes. And I know I'm oversimplifying and you can call me unfair, but I'm also summarizing because it's not what this episode's ultimately about. Or we don't live in a mechanical world. We do have free will in some form, way, shape, or form. And God made us in his image. And then our job as his image bearers is to be fully human. It's one of those two. And yeah, there's a lot of nuances and all of that at play. But if you believe that God created us with at least some degree of free will, then we do have to take a human perspective, not in the absence of God, but in order to say, what does it mean to be human? If God created you to be human, what does it mean to be human? You better figure that out. And it doesn't mean or at least it better not mean reducing everything to a mathematical equation. And my argument is, in the same way that scientism does that, everything's ultimately science. We fetishize science, like, literally, in our culture. You know, and then we have the same version theologically over here. That's my argument.
All right. John Piper is local, so who knows? Maybe we could get him on the show.
Yeah.
You wouldn't like that? That'd be fun.
It'd be fine. I'm sure he'd out-debate me, but I'd still be right. That's what you gotta, you know. Just a digression there. Not that I would ever actually be in a position to debate John Piper, and if I did, I'm sure I would be destroyed. But all a debate teaches you is who's the better debater. So that's something to remember, including when I make good arguments. Like, if you're convinced by my arguments, it just means that I'm more convincing than somebody who would disagree with me. That's all it means. All right. So, going on with that same point, again, this relates to schizophrenia. In schizophrenia, subjects say that they find themselves, like scientists, not involved in the world, merely observing it from outside to understand its secret workings. One finds himself a detached onlooker. Another reports that I am like an anthropologist. A schizophrenic patient, Anne, complained bitterly that for her, it was as if I examined the whole world mechanism from the outside. Descartes had aspired to be a spectator rather than an actor in all the comedies in the world displays. As Minkowski aptly remarks of schizophrenic subjects, they sit by like spectators on the life that plays itself out around them. They neither act nor feel. Okay, now you can start to see where's the real danger in making science the main filter for reality. Well, because this is exactly what science desires to do, is to sit abstracted from whatever it is you're studying and make tabula rasa conclusions about it. You come at it as a blank slate, you observe it neutrally, you make your observations. And I want to say, I'm not coming at this anti-science, which I just love that term. Like, who's anti-science? Like, you're against hydrogen? What does that even mean? You know, it's just the dumbest little slander that people throw around, and it doesn't have any meaning, and it becomes readily apparent when they don't have anything but the slogan, but that's neither here nor there. So I'm not anti-science, but I'm also not so pro-science. Like, to me, the question of anti-science or pro-science is really dangerous when people start putting it in those terms, because... Let me ask you this. Are you pro-hammers or anti-hammers?
I guess pro.
Right. It's like, well, that's not even a meaningful question. Are you pro-screwdrivers or anti-screwdrivers? It's like, well, I don't know. Do I need a screwdriver right now? Yeah. Like, yes, science is one of the most powerful tools humanity has ever discovered. Period. But when it comes down to it, it is a tool. And so... it is not the be-all and end-all of our reality any more than a screwdriver or a hammer is. It's a meaningless statement. And unfortunately, what our modern world has done, especially with the fetishization of science, has taken that and put it over everything. It's become the primary filter for reality, and it's remarkably dangerous. All right, a little bit more. Rejection of myth. You know, this is one that's going to get my motor running. To my mind, all that we have looked at here approximates the bizarre alienated condition enjoined on us today and reinforced by a toxic combination of bureaucratic and scientistic, not necessarily scientific, and I like that distinction, scientistic being the fetishized cult-like version of it, thinking with that of the philosophers and pseudo-philosophers of the school of nothing buttery, all tending to the view that we are machines. Nietzsche bemoaned the state of normal human beings, those semi-animals unhinged from instinct and no longer able to count on the guidance of their unconscious drives, being forced instead to think, deduce, calculate, weigh, cause, and effect. Unhappy people, reduced to their weakest, most fallible organ, their consciousness. Nietzsche is describing the loss of intuition, or the right hemisphere's take, which is wholly and adequately replaced by that of the left hemisphere. The schizophrenic is the apotheosis of this tendency in modern man. Nietzsche's prototype of theoretical man and his determination to destroy myth. Myth is otherwise known as the deep, embodied, imaginative understanding available to the right hemisphere, as seen by the left hemisphere as a lie. Okay, so that's a, you know, like, why is our society moved so much to rejecting myth? That should trouble us. And again, let me dip my toe into some controversial theological water. I'm going to argue that the young earth creationist crowd does exactly this. The young earth creationist crowd, the insistence that everything has to be read as scientifically literal in the Bible as opposed to myth, is the rejection of myth. And it's a rejection of seeing the world as a human, because humans see the world through myth. Sorry.
All right. Not there. I thought you were going to go on, but you just quietly shrugged to me. Sorry. Do you want to say anything more about?
I mean, I think we've covered a lot of Genesis 1, so I'd maybe just say refer back to that material and say put this filter on it.
Okay.
Ideology is a feature of this, and this is kind of fun because this is another one of these intersection points between Frank Herbert and Ian. Minkowski, I don't know who all these people are, it's just authors he's referencing, gives an account of a patient whose attitude is alarmingly close to the ambitions of some scientists, analytic philosophers, and bureaucrats, representing a freewheeling left hemisphere. "As far as I am concerned, a plan is everything in life," the patient tells us. "I wouldn't upset my plan for anything. I'd rather upset life than the plan. It's a feeling for symmetry, for regularity, which makes my plan so attractive. Life displays neither regularity nor symmetry, and that's why I fabricate reality. All my strengths I put down to my brain." I'd rather upset life than my plan. That is the problem with ideology in a nutshell. Ideology is a plan. And it's like, you know, you hear the old adage that any battle plan works until the first shots are fired. Well, life kind of works that way, too. This is the danger of ideology. Ideology says this is the plan for everything, everywhere, all the time. And then, of course, life comes along and it doesn't fit into the ideologic box. So it doesn't work. And this is where we find ourselves. And this is, again, what's part of the danger that makes you less human. Because everything is driving you to sign up for ideology. Everything. Everything. Like Twitter, Facebook, the algorithm wants you bought into ideology. Not just political ideologies, but any type of ideology. Give yourself over to the plan. That's it. Documenting. I think this is some of what we were getting at here before. And this is kind of the, well, I have a little bit more, but I promise we're almost done. Schizophrenia and modern society have an obsession with recording. This is where it starts to get convicting for all of us with Goodreads and Letterboxd accounts.
Oh, yeah.
This is going to be horrible. Yeah, we'll get through it together.
No, this will be tough.
I'm forcibly put in mind of Walter Benjamin saying already in 1936 that in the modern era, experience has fallen in value, and it looks as if it is continuing to fall into bottomlessness. And of Ferdinand Kurenberger's dictum, das Leben lebt nicht, life doesn't live. Consequently, there is a need to represent constantly the left hemisphere's mode of being after the fact in an attempt to produce continuity. So a lot of ideas there. Let's keep rolling. Tie it together. This is like Descartes' remark that the world must be constantly reconstructed at every moment or it disappears. Indeed, one of Jasper's patients actually says the world must be represented or the world will disappear. One schizophrenic subject felt he must actively put together the fragments of time which he captured in photographs in order to reassure himself that the world existed. And hence comes the very modern necessity of recording, repeating experience in representation. No longer present and hence experience, time for the left hemisphere becomes a frozen record. So as I read that, I started to think about a shirt I saw this summer that I thought was very funny. And then I read this and didn't think it was funny at all, which it said, if it isn't on Strava, it didn't happen.
Oh, that's our app that we use for biking and running.
Yeah, it's probably the best, you know, the most famous fitness app there, but it's just another app to record stuff. Like, oh, that's kind of scary.
I do kind of feel like that sometimes.
Don't you kind of?
Yes, if you forget, or like you're halfway into your run and or your bike, I know you do more cycling, and you're like, oh, I have to start it. And it's like,
the first half doesn't count.
Yeah, it doesn't count because you're logging your miles.
I got my running total for the year. It's like, oh. Didn't the only ones that count though are the ones on Strava. Take a little ride around the block with your kids, that doesn't count.
Here's another thing. When I was really into logging movies and trying to get to a certain number, if I found any sort of like smaller film, or I mean, let me say it a different way. If I found a DVD special feature if it was on Letterboxd, I'd be happy to watch it because I could log that evidence that I watched it. If the special feature wasn't on Letterboxd, I would not watch it because I would never have any proof that I ever watched it. I don't know exactly how to explain it.
It's perfect. And I think you almost don't have to explain it because I bet every person, if you don't get it, count your lucky stars and move on with your life. For the rest of us, this is group therapy.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about Goodreads and Letterboxd. And as you were just reading that passage, I was thinking, how many times are we here on the show and we mention a movie or a book and I need to go to my own review to even remember what I thought about it? It's not just that I forgot about it.
Yeah.
Well, it's like once I logged it, I let it leave my brain.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll forget even the title of a book that I know I've read a book, but I don't know the title. Sometimes I'll forget that I've even read a book in general and I'll have to find on Goodreads, oh, I've already read this one. I mean, is this what you're talking about?
100%.
So recording it, documenting it, makes it leave our brain?
Yeah, so let's go on. Because the next step then, and you can say, like, oh, I'm not this extreme. Fine, but let's just see it. Again, the point is to see it in the mental illness and then see, oh, we're kind of running down that same path. Mm-hmm. The record becomes the reality.
Mm-hmm.
There's a saying in modern managed hospital medicine designed to stress the importance of keeping accurate records. If it's not recorded, it didn't happen. Okay, well, there's the same idea.
Yeah.
Interestingly, for the Greeks, while literacy was still not common, live testimony was required to affirm the truth of a piece of writing, not the other way around. That's one of those things where, like, you start to realize people thought radically differently than you. And it's not that we should go back to that, but maybe there's something, like, if that idea seems so foreign. Imagine going to court. Your Honor, I have the accused on tape confessing he murdered his wife. Well, we're going to need somebody to back that up. Like, what? Like, that's so 100% foreign to how we think. Doesn't mean we should go back to that, but maybe it means there's something we've lost by leaving that, too. All right. Well, this is a necessary part of accountability and not in itself reprehensible. It does actually state that representation is more real, at least in some contexts, than what actually happened at the time. Nurses and other caregivers have to spend so much time recording what they do that they have little time left in which to do it. The police are similarly handicapped, and I suspect that not even the self-employed are able entirely to escape this blight on life. The record is frozen, but life has flowed away as life does. And in our left hemisphere-dominated, record-obsessed age, I've heard people say the same thing about taking photographs of their lives. If it isn't recorded, it didn't happen. Let's go on to the next quote here. I mentioned earlier that one might think of left hemisphere prepotency as like confusing the map with the world that it maps. Social media, with its endless recording of the trivia of daily life, and we could extend that to the Letterboxd and Goodreads and Stravas of the world, often seems like that. A Spanish professor of animal physiology, a presumably intelligent man, records everything he does. It occurred shortly after turning 40, he says. I was looking back on my life and wondering what did I have to show? Literally to show for his life. There's an alliance here with the man who didn't have a seat in life. So he started writing down everything he did, saw, ate, thus ensuring that he would have nothing whatever to show for the rest of his life, apart from the fact that it had been recorded. Then he started taking photographs every 30 seconds. He has now accumulated more than 1 million photos. Unsurprisingly, he says, he hasn't seen a lot of them. It's almost too much to go through. He admits that really my devices looking back tell me little except the intensity is hard to capture. The pointless details overwhelm and kill. Stern was the first to spot and parody this modern tendency in the mid-18th century. Now we have Facebook accounts of the minutiae of empty lives. Who's uncomfortable? Probably all of us should be. Like, that's so incredibly convicting. It's like, I go back to the people at the ocean with their phones out. I don't care how good your phone is or how talented you are at photography or videography or any of that. You haven't captured what it's like to stand in front of the ocean without your phone. Period. That's really scary. How much we're throwing that away.
So since the show started, we've been big proponents of Goodreads. And ever since we became aware of Letterboxd, we've used that regularly. Let's just talk about those two things, logging movies, logging books. What are your takeaways going forward? Are you going to cut back or what's your plan?
I don't know. It's hard because it's like, Is there a benefit? Yeah, there is in the abstract. It's nice to know. Like, sometimes you do forget. It's nice to know, oh, I did read that book. Oh, I do like this author. What did I think about this movie when I watched it 5 years ago? I'll give you it at its best. At its best, it becomes a conversation with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And with other people, too. But especially with yourself. And that's kind of great.
I mean, that is how I've said it so many times. That's how I use it. I think you use your letterbox right now to entertain with good, like a good review. Mine is a journal entry.
Right.
Here, Matt, future Matt, here's what you thought about this film.
Right. Okay. So that's, but what's the dark side? The dark side is what you described. The dark side is choosing to shift what you read or watch because it records easily. Like, if you found a book you wanted to read and it wasn't on Goodreads, would you want to read it?
I've literally not read a book because it was too local to, like, small publishing house. Yeah, I didn't read it because it wasn't on Goodreads.
Let me put words to that, and maybe this resonates with you, but this is how I've found myself thinking. That one's a waste of time. It's a waste. Why? Because what really counts is if I can get it on Goodreads.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what a terrible, like, it's the complete inversion. The tool is now in charge.
Yeah.
The tool that is supposed to be there to enhance your life, to add these things to it, has now taken away from it. Oh, horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible, horrible. If you suddenly were without your phone or any other type of recording device, would you exercise less? Like, let's say for the next month, and I know it take the temperature out of it because it's getting colder. Let's say it's going to be good temperature for the next month. You don't have any way to record it. Would you exercise less? Probably.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's like, it's scary, though, because here again, the tool that's supposed to help you improve yourself, and can, and in some ways has. We're not ideologues. Okay? This isn't, let's flip our ideology. Has now taken away from that. It's now like you've become a slave to it. Okay? So let me read one last quote, and then I want to come to that point, because that's really the central crux. Freezing time kills. Our age is one of representation. Photography, sound recording, and film have become so important to us that they can come almost to supersede direct experience. We talk about aid memoir as though we were preserving a memory. But research shows that photographs actually erode memories. The effect of taking photos is that they substitute for memories, as you can verify by thinking back to any travels you made some years ago, of which you still have photographs. The photos tend to crowd out memory of all else, and time is sliced.
I get that. So you remember more clearly the things you took pictures of because you're actually remembering looking at the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've heard this before, that all of our memories are just, we're just remembering the last time we remembered it.
Right.
So when you start to, well, when you stop thinking about a certain thing, all of a sudden you're going to just forget about it. Not because it was so long ago, because you didn't try, you didn't practice remembering it.
Right. Right.
So if you're looking at your vacation photos and you have certain incidents where, oh yeah, and you kind of refresh those memories, that's easier. So it's almost like the pictures are jogging your memory.
Oh, totally. No, that's 100% it. And it's like, is that bad? Like, is photography bad? No. Photography's a tool. But here's the point. Here's the point. I'm going to go back to what Frank Herbert says, because this is where his quote is so brilliant. Butlerian jihad. Once men gave their thinking over to machines, and that allowed other men with machines to enslave them. That what we just described from our personal lives is that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You say, well, yeah, maybe, but hang on. If you're addicted to your phone in a small way or a lot, where you have, if you find yourself scrolling through Facebook or Twitter, or Reddit, whatever, and you find yourself doing that regularly, other men with machines, the ones who program the algorithm, are controlling you.
Mm-hmm.
You're controlling what you're mad about, controlling what you believe, you're controlling what you buy, you're controlling what you think. And you have to have enough honesty to say, maybe not perfectly so, but we're literally giving our thinking over to machines. Like, this is terrifying.
You know, this reminds me, I know you haven't watched this documentary, but there's it was popular a few years ago, that documentary on Netflix called Social Dilemma.
Right.
You haven't watched that, have you?
No.
And I've always said I don't necessarily care. I thought the point of the documentary was going to be people are watching what you're doing on social media. I mean, I don't love that, but I have nothing to hide, so not a huge deal if people can see what I'm looking at. But what the bigger issue was in this documentary was not that they can see what you're doing. It's more that they are controlling what you're thinking.
Yes.
Like they can make you think differently and you don't even know what's happening. And that was the thing that made me the most unsettled. I don't want somebody to be able to influence my thinking and I'm totally unaware of it. So I, for a long period of time, I had Facebook off my phone. I actually just recently, like in the last 2-3 weeks, since you've been gone, since we stopped podcasting. No, I had a reason for bringing it back on. I felt relieved to not have it on my phone.
Right.
And I don't know how it was helping me in my thinking, but at the base level, it's a relief to not have that to scroll through and lose time to.
Yeah. No, totally. Totally. And it's like, think about this. Here's a very real scenario that's probably happened to every one of us without you knowing it. Like there's this whole deal with Elon Musk's lawsuit with Twitter, and the crux of it is how many bot accounts are there on Twitter. Well, whoever's right, the answer is a lot. So I guarantee you this has happened to you. One bot has gotten in a fight with another bot, and you've gotten invested in it. Think about that. Now, it sounds silly, okay? But what about when they're fighting over who the next president should be? And suddenly, your thinking on that is being influenced by two machines who don't care because they're machines fighting about it. That has happened to every person who's ever been on Twitter or Reddit, any of it. You've given your thinking over to machines. So it's a terrifying thing. Okay. So to me, a couple of wrap-up takeaway things. So first of all, you say, does this apply to me? Well, let me ask you this. Do you have pictures of fireworks on your phone? Because if so, then it applies to you. I can't imagine anything less worthwhile than that.
That's awesome. I do.
then you're guilty.
I, as recently as August, took pictures of fireworks.
Like, yeah, you will never look at those. And if you do, like, fireworks are like the ultimate example of this. Because every picture of them sucks.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
There's no such thing as a good picture of a firework. It's just none. They don't exist. So for me, I'll bring it to my experience first. I read this material on my plane ride to Myrtle Beach about a month ago. And it was like not a call to arms, but a call to radically change this. And throughout the last month, I've ebbed and flowed with this. I've had times where I've sat there scrolling on my phone when I shouldn't. But overall, I've tried to do less. Okay? And I want to stress that because the point isn't to be perfect. The point is to not be a slave. And I can tell you I feel more human. Or at least, and when I don't do as well, I feel less human. Like, well, how do you quantify that? It's kind of a left brain question, number one, but it comes down to like, do I feel here? Do I feel like I'm present? Do I feel engaged with what's going on? Do I feel like I'm interacting with reality, not an abstraction? Those are some of the things I find myself asking. It's something as simple as if I'm watching a show or a movie, am I watching it? Or am I like half paying attention and half scrolling through things on my phone? Well, when I do that, I feel less human. I actually feel less human. I don't think that's too strong a point for it. Why? Because here's something that I care about, like film, you know, even if it's something dumb that's less important, like just something I care about, something I genuinely want to invest my time in. I'm interested in, I'm passionate about it. And I'm giving it away so that I can see bots arguing with themselves on Twitter. So I can see people, you know, getting you revved up and emotionally invested in a political controversy that no one will remember in 2 weeks. That's what's happening. It's scary. So that's my story. Like, and I'm in the middle of it. And say, what do you do with this? Try and do 10% better. That's it. So what does 10% better look like? Well, maybe it means that if you can't put down your phone while you're watching something, you're watching a 60-minute show, make yourself have the phone down for the first 6 minutes. That's 10% better. See how you feel after that. 10% better. Just do it. Like, you can do that. That's manageable. You don't have to be perfect. Doesn't mean go delete everything. Doesn't mean stop recording. Do 10% better. Okay, where are we going with this then? Because I mentioned this is a trilogy of episodes.
Yeah.
Next episode, doppelgangers. Doppelgangers has bounced around a lot. And I think it's fitting that it's still out there. Because a lot of times when we have an idea and we don't hit it right away, it fades. And this one hasn't. And it's been through a few iterations in my mind. And they're kind of all going to be present. Well, this is a, like, when I think about what is a doppelganger from a mythological perspective. And don't worry, we're going to get into some kooky material too. So I got you covered if you want literal doppelgangers. It's like, it's this. It's the confrontation between the you that is human and the you that wants to sacrifice your humanity. You know, you could put it in theological terms when Paul talks about struggling with the flesh. Isn't he describing doppelgangers? You know, when Carl Jung talks about the shadow self, confronting that, incorporating that. You know, what is that dark side to you that maybe you need to face? And specifically then, how is burying yourself in their phone preventing you from facing it? Like, because when you start to be a human, it's not everything's great. Like, it's actually hard to be a human. You do this for a reason, because it's easy. Like, you do this because it's easy and to not actually act alive. Like, that's the reality. When you're living as a human, when you're trying to do that, when you're doing your 10%, it sucks because you're bad at it and it's hard and it hurts and it's painful and you have to actually live in the world and you have to take responsibility for things and that sucks. But it's also good. Like, it's hard, but it's better. It's fulfilling. It's meaningful. It's like, it's not this murky, dead place where we're living. That's the doppelganger myth right there. And then, you know, where are we going with that? Well, I want to primarily explore it through the lens of two great artists. One of them is David Lynch, who I mentioned. The other one, Shakespeare. I don't think it's an accident that a great modern artist living in the midst of what we're going through now, but also arguably the greatest artistic voice of all time, both lived with doppelgangers in their works. They're all over the place in both of theirs. I don't think that's an accident.
Yeah, I don't know about this. I mean, I know some of Lynch, but not very much about Shakespeare.
Yeah, just doubling in Shakespeare. It's all over the place. All over the place. You know, it's crazy how much there is.
Okay.
And so it's not an accident. So this theme of having to confront yourself is a major part of what it means to be human, to confront that shadow self, your evil self, your Mr. Hyde, whatever it is a major part of what it means to be human. It's not an accident. And our age's manifestation of it is this, at least a primary manifestation. I don't want to be reductionistic. Okay. And then the final episode, the Butlerian Manifesto, is what is our actual response to this? What is the appropriate human response to all of this? Inspired by the Butlerian Jihad in Frank Herbert, which was a religious overthrowing of the machines. Is that what we need? No, I'm not calling for a jihad, but I want to call for us to take it seriously. I think there's a larger conversation, and we don't have a huge audience, but the audience we have, I want to start contributing to it. All right? There's a conversation humanity needs to have with itself. That's where I want to take to it. This today was the problem. Next is the mythic outworking of it. Last one is the response. That's where we're going.
All right. I love it. I've been looking forward to this trilogy. Well, like I said, we had to take a few weeks off, so I've known this was happening.
Right. It might be a few weeks before we get to Doppelganger, but we'll get there.
What? A few weeks? Well, we're off next week. Yeah. We'll figure it out. I could possibly do next Thursday. Okay. Maybe. Would that work for you or not?
I think it would.
All right. Well, listeners, we'll figure it out off the air. But for now, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono.
And we're the Sci-Fi Christians. Signing off.
Goodbye. Thank you.